depth under the prominent nose. What the 7-year-old Michael remembered as a dream of paradise was really the dying moments of a marriage. Every 2 weeks, she made radio contact with Moscow, passing messages back and forth from the Bulgarian florist and spymaster Stoyan Vladov. In Moscow, she had been taught to blow up bridges and run undercover agents. Back in Poland, she was little more than a secret postman. Elsewhere in the world, her fellow communists were fighting furiously as the Nazi threat escalated and Europe lurched towards war. Johann Patra was still in China, running a new network of agents and saboteurs against the Japanese. It was over 2 years since they had parted in Peking. She still missed him. In Spain, the Republicans were in retreat. In Berlin, the last vestiges of Ursula's old life were being destroyed. By mid-1938, more than 250,000 Jews had fled Germany and Austria, while hundreds of thousands more were attempting to escape. The remnants of the communist underground prepared for armed resistance. In England, Jürgen was churning out anti-fascist tracts and swiftly emerging as the de facto leader of the German émigré communists in Britain. Ursula watched these events unfold with horror and frustration. "I felt I was not accomplishing much in Poland." She needed another adventure. In 1938, she requested permission to come to Moscow once more. By now, none of her friends and German comrades remained. She told Comrade Hadschi she was ready for a new challenge. The centre had also concluded that Agent Sonia was being underused. It was agreed that her next mission would be in neutral Switzerland, the country with the world's highest per capita quotient of spies and a prime target of Soviet espionage. Ursula's father had contacts at the League of Nations in Geneva who might prove useful. Rudi could probably get work there as an architect. Switzerland was already providing sanctuary for thousands of fleeing Germans. One more family of Jewish refugees would easily blend in. At her final briefing, Colonel Mamsirov informed Ursula that she had been promoted to major, which came as a shock, since she had been unaware of holding any formal military rank. "I did not know how to salute, let alone march." She was flattered nonetheless. "I was proud to be a soldier of the Red Army." Before leaving Moscow, she was introduced to a young German named Franz Obermanns. 5 years her junior, Obermanns was a former waiter and a member of the communist resistance in Berlin who had been arrested by the Gestapo before escaping to fight in Spain with the 13th International Brigade. Mamsurov explained that the young man had completed his radio training and would be following Ursula to Switzerland, where he would act as her junior officer and assistant. Obermanns was enthusiastic, brave, and quite stupid. He would travel on a false Finnish passport, under the name Eriki Noki. An odd choice of cover, since Obermanns had never been to Finland, knew nothing of the country, and spoke not a single word of Finnish. Switzerland, peaceful land of cowbells and cuckoo clocks, has the oldest policy of military neutrality in the world, having successfully avoided involvement in any war since 1815. This made it ideal for spying and exceptionally unsafe. Sandwiched between Nazi Germany and Austria, fascist Italy and democratic France, it was a hotbed of international espionage. The Germans, British, French, Soviets and Americans all ran competing spy networks in the country, using Switzerland as a base to launch operations into enemy territory. The undercover war in Shanghai had been brutal but haphazard. In Manchuria, Ursula had dodged the murderously proficient Kempetai. In Poland and Danzig, she was a courier to the communist underground. But in Switzerland, the game was different. The country was riddled with espionage, an international hunting ground for spies of every stamp. Everyone spied on everyone else, and the Swiss Security Service spied, politely but insistently, on all the other spies. The Soviet Union fearful and distrustful of Hitler, needed information on the military build-up inside the Reich. And neutral Switzerland, sharing a 225-mile border with Nazi Germany, was the ideal place from which to gather such intelligence. Ursula was ordered to travel to Switzerland via Britain, settle somewhere near Geneva, construct an illegal radio transmitter receiver, make contact with the pre-existing Soviet intelligence networks, and establish a reliable wireless link with Moscow using a memorized set of ciphers. At the same time, the center instructed her to recruit her own team of agents to be infiltrated into Germany to gather military information and conduct sabotage operations. For the first time, Ursula would be directly targeting Hitler's regime. She could hardly wait. The Nazis had plenty of their own spies in Switzerland and a number of informants inside Swiss intelligence. The police had developed a highly efficient system for detecting illegal wireless sets, and the Swiss government was strictly neutral and uniformly severe when it came to espionage. Anyone caught spying of whatever nationality or political allegiance faced arrest and deportation. If Ursula was sent back to Germany, she would be killed. Unless, of course, the Gestapo or its agents found out what she was up to and opted to murder her in Switzerland instead. Before leaving Moscow, Ursula made a suggestion. Might she find recruits in London on her way to Switzerland and send them into Germany as undercover agents? Numerous British communists had volunteered to fight in Spain in the International Brigade, and among the survivors might be some willing to continue the battle against fascism by being inserted into Germany as penetration spies. Britain still enjoyed a certain status in Germany, and despite the rising enmity between the two nations, Ursula pointed out, it was not unusual for the odd, well-to-do Englishman to turn up there on holiday, even in 1938. This was the first time she had taken the initiative and framed a plan of her own. She was no longer merely obeying orders. Ursula was making the transition from spy to spymaster. The centre agreed. While visiting her family in London, she should try to enlist one or two comrades who had given proof of their courage and reliability in the course of the Spanish Civil War, and then start for Geneva. She should avoid contact with the Communist Party of Great Britain, CPGB. Colonel Mamsurov finally handed over a sheet of paper and told her to sign it. A statement that admitted the right of the centre to have her shot if she disclosed her cipher to a third party without authorization. It was not a legal document, but a warning. In Shanghai, she had worked under Sorge. In Mukden, she had spied alongside Patra. In Poland, Rudy had been her designated aide. She would be taking off for Switzerland as a solo spy. She and Rudy had come to realize that we could no longer live together. For the last 2 years, their partnership had survived only on joint parenting and a shared ideology, but now the marriage was finally over, without rancor. Rudy announced he would be returning to Shanghai, where he wished to resume his architectural practice and begin working independently for Soviet military intelligence. He intended to spend the summer in America, spending time with his brother Victor, now a professor of embryology at Washington University in St. Louis, and then complete a course in radio technology in Paris to ensure he was ready to take up full-time spying back in China. Mamsurov agreed, somewhat reluctantly. Rudy's plans for his future espionage career were more ambitious than anything Moscow had in mind. Ursula's German passport was carefully doctored by the forgers of the Fourth Department, with blank pages stitched in to replace the pages which had contained visas, stamps, etc., of her sojourn in the Far East. It appeared to show that she had spent the last 2 years in Germany. On the 10th of June 1938, she arrived in Britain, yet another Jewish refugee, indistinguishable from the flood seeking safety. She told the immigration authorities she intended to stay with her parents for about 3 months and signed a formal undertaking to leave by the 20th of September. I understand that should I overstay the period allowed, steps will be taken to compel me to return to Germany, notwithstanding any pleas to the contrary. Despite the popular myth, Britain did not open its arms to all German Jews, especially communist ones. The Kaczynskis were still living in Hampstead. Brigitte had married a Scottish communist, Anthony Lewis, and moved into the Isokon building 2 doors from her parents in Lawn Road, a modernist block of flats that would become infamous as home to a suspiciously large number of communist spies. Jürgen took up residence in nearby Upper Park Road. The British left had embraced these distinguished German-Jewish intellectual refugees with enthusiasm. Indeed, as one historian puts it, the Kaczynskis' list of friends and acquaintances reads almost like a who's who of British left-wing political, academic, and literary life of the period. Writers such as Cecil Day Lewis, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, Rosamund Lehmann, Rose Macaulay, John Strachey and Stephen Spender, the publisher Victor Gallants, Labour politicians Aneurin Bevin and Tom Dryburgh, the historian Arnold Toynbee, and many more. Jürgen even became friendly with Sylvia Pankhurst, the suffragette campaigner, and Lillian Bowes-Lyon, the then Queen's first cousin. It was quite hard to attend a Hampstead dinner party in 1938 without bumping into a Kaczynski. Jürgen was the standard-bearer of German anti-fascism in Britain, chief among the swelling community of exiled German communists. He toured the country giving lectures, raised funds for refugees, held scores of meetings, nurtured contacts on the British left, and wrote unstoppably. Pamphlets, histories, reports, propaganda leaflets. He started work on his History of Labour Conditions, which he would continue to expand for the rest of his life. When not scribbling, he was soliciting funds for Freedom Radio 29.8, an anti-Nazi station broadcasting to Germany, for which Albert Einstein, Ernest Hemingway and Thomas Mann wrote scripts, and helping to found the Free German League of Culture, a German anti-national socialist, anti-fascist, non-party refugee organisation with the aim of nurturing German culture. Jürgen Kaczynski was inexhaustible and completely exhausting. Secretly, Jürgen was also writing political and economic reports for the Soviet Union, which were couriered back to Moscow via the Soviet embassy. A frequent visitor to Jürgen's home was the Soviet press attaché, Anatoly Gromov, real name Gorsky, in reality the chief of Soviet intelligence in Britain, codenamed Vadim. He flattered Jürgen, telling him his reports were valued in Moscow for their ice-cold logic. Between his arrival in Britain and the fall of France, Jürgen made trips to Paris whenever the laws of conspiracy allowed, to take orders and pass information to the Comintern and the exiled KPD leaders. Jürgen Kaczynski was a committed communist secretly sending intelligence to Stalin. He knew his sister was involved in Soviet espionage, though he did not know the extent. He believed it his comradely duty to pass valuable information to the Soviet Union. Whether that made him a spy was a matter of perspective. The British secret services did not know quite what to make of the Kaczynskis. They were committed opponents of Nazism, to be sure, but they were also Germans, communists, and Jews, which made them triply suspect in the eyes of MI5, an organisation with its fair share of anti-Semites. MI5 knew about Jürgen's communist activities and his trips to Paris, but nothing of his contacts with Soviet intelligence. The LSE professor Robert Kaczynski was considered more dubious than his son. Brigitte was known to be an active member of the CPGB North London branch. The family was being watched. But as war with Germany drew closer, MI5 was more concerned with digging out Nazi spies than a handful of communist sympathisers in leafy Hampstead. Ursula immediately set to work. At Moscow's suggestion, she contacted Fred Ullmann, a German poet, lawyer, painter, communist and Spanish Civil War veteran, and asked him if any of his British former comrades in the international brigades might be willing to undertake illegal, dangerous work inside Germany. Ullmann passed on the inquiry to Douglas Springhall, a fellow international brigader, who in turn contacted Fred Copeman, former leader of the British battalion. Copeman recommended a young volunteer who had just returned to Britain. Alexander Alan Foote is one of the most important, but also one of the most enduringly mysterious figures in modern espionage history. The son of a poultry farmer from Yorkshire, Foote was 32, with receding fair hair swept back from a wide forehead and sharp blue eyes. He left school at 16 to work in a garage before becoming a coal merchant and then, as he put it, a restless sales manager for a chicken feed business. He did not share his father's single-minded passion for chicken farming. Foote was a strange mixture of parts, pleasure-loving, adventurous, opportunistic, and charming. While still a teenager, he attended communist discussion groups, but it was the outbreak of the Spanish conflict in 1936 that provided him with a handy, albeit shallow, political philosophy. "The Civil War seemed to show everything up in black and white," he wrote. The Spanish nationalists and their fascist allies were trying to destroy democracy, and the Republicans were defending it with the help of the Soviet Union. It all seemed as simple as that. He did not join the Communist Party, but described himself as a bit of a Bolshe. Foote joined the RAF in 1935, but on the 23rd of December 1936, on the point of being thrown out, he deserted from Gosport barracks, bolted to London, and then embarked for Spain with several hundred other idealistic British volunteer fighters, most of whom would not return. Foote's motives were only partly political. He had got a girl pregnant and decided the risk in Spain was less than that posed by her enraged father. The British battalion, part of the 6th International Brigade, assembled in Catalonia, consisting of British, Irish and colonial citizens, a handful of Swedes, and a slightly baffled Ethiopian. Most were communists of one shade or another. Sergeant Foote was appointed transport officer. He remained in Spain for 2 years and ended up as batman to Copeman, a former Royal Navy heavyweight boxer. As battalion commander, Copeman left something to be desired. He was described by one of his men as more or less insane, giving completely inconsequential orders to everybody in sight and offering to bash their faces in if they did not comply. Nonetheless, Copeman saw in Foote something more than just another angry young man looking to die for a cause. In the autumn of 1938, Foote was allowed to return to the UK to attend the 15th Communist Congress in Birmingham Town Hall, which he found very boring. Soon afterwards, Foote was invited to dinner with Copeman and his wife, Kitty, at their home in Lewisham. "Springhall has asked me to recommend someone for an assignment," said Copeman, who had recently been invalided home from Spain after being shot in the face and neck. "We think that you might fit the bill. I know nothing about the assignment save that it will be abroad and very dangerous." Foote immediately accepted, despite, as he put it, having no notion of whom I would be working for what purpose. Copeman scribbled down an address in Hampstead. By this point, Ursula had already departed for Switzerland, leaving Dover on the 24th of September, 1938. So when Foote knocked on the green door in Lawn Road, it was not Ursula who opened it, but Brigitte, now anglicised to Mrs. Bridget Lewis. Ursula's younger sister had become an accessory to Soviet espionage, and she knew precisely what to do if and when a man called Alexander Foote appeared. Foote sat a little nervously in a chintz-covered armchair, while a respectable housewife with a slight foreign accent grilled him over tea and biscuits. The whole atmosphere of the flat was one of complete middle-class respectability. After 10 minutes, the interview was over. I was dealt with by the lady of the house as briskly and impersonally as she would have engaged a housemaid. "You will proceed to Geneva," said Brigitte, handing him a £10 note. There you will be contacted and further instructions will be given to you. Her next words might have come straight from the pages of a second-rate spy novel. On Thursday next week, you must be waiting outside the General Post Office in Geneva at exactly midday. You must wear a white scarf and carry a leather belt in your right hand. At noon, you will be approached by a woman carrying a string shopping bag containing a green parcel. She will say, in English, "Where did you buy that belt?" You will reply, "I bought it in an ironmonger's shop in Paris." You will then ask her where you can buy an orange like hers, and she will reply, "You can have it for an English penny." Chapter 12. The Molehill. Ursula was living in a Swiss picture postcard. The little farmhouse in the mountains above Lake Geneva, near the village of Caux-sur-Montreux, was surrounded by some of the most majestic scenery in the world. Before us, the meadows descended to the forest, and the forest to the valley, where the lake and the ribbon of the Rhone sparkled, she wrote. The Alps rose magnificently in the distance, and behind the house, lush pastures led up to a pine-covered ridge beneath the summit at Rocher de Naye. The nearest neighbours were the farmer and his wife, a quarter of a mile distant. A narrow path led to the village of Caux, from which a winding road ran down to Montreux on the lake. At night, from the cowshed at the back of the building, came the sounds of gentle bovine breathing. In the evenings, Ursula played lotto with Michael, while Nina combed her doll's hair and Ollo sewed and sang. As the sun went down, Ursula stood by the open window, breathing in the serenity. The air was cool. I had known so many countries, cities, villages, apartments, hotels, boarding houses. Never before and never since have I lived in such a wonderful landscape. The farmhouse had been advertised in the window of a Geneva rental agency. It felt like a refuge from a world falling apart. The term mole, as a slang for a spy, was not coined until the 1960s. But to modern ears, the name of the farmhouse sounds distinctly apt. La Taupinière, the molehill. At night, when everyone was asleep, Ursula constructed her transmitter receiver from parts bought at hardware shops in Geneva, Vevey and Lausanne. Keypad, an antenna with banana plugs, and two heavy batteries each the size of a dictionary, which she hid in the hayloft. At the back of the bottom shelf in the built-in wardrobe was a panel held in place by screws, behind which was just enough space to hide the assembled equipment. She drilled two small holes in the plywood partition and fed through the leads, enabling her to use the transmitter without removing it from the cupboard. When disconnected, the holes were concealed with wooden plugs resembling knots in the wood. The hidden transmitter might evade a superficial house search, but she knew that if it was located by taking radio signals, even the best hiding place would be useless. Ursula moved the large wooden bed alongside the wardrobe so that I could see the mountains and communicate with Moscow while sitting up in bed. On the 29th of September 1938, a clear, cool night, ideal for transmitting, Ursula tested her homemade radio for the first time. At 11:20 p.m., she established a good connection on a frequency of 6.1182 MHz and tapped out her call sign and a brief message, half a dozen groups comprised of five numbers each. She imagined the message as a shooting star. With the speed of light, my numbers streaked across the sky, where the half moon was visible, arrived where they were expected, helped the comrades, and gave them strength. Some 1,500 kilometres away, in the receiving station at Dymowka Forest near the Polish-Ukrainian border, a Red Army operator picked up the signal and sent back a brief acknowledgement. From Dymowka, the news that Sonia's transmitter was functioning passed to the centre and the desk of Major Vera Polyakova, the woman officer in charge of Swiss espionage. Flooded with relief, Ursula stood at the open window. I leaned my elbows on the ledge and looked out. Even the night air smelled of woods and meadows, and it was very quiet. Too pumped with adrenaline for sleep, she lay awake for hours before turning on her transistor radio and tuning into the BBC, quietly, so as not to wake the household. The news banished sleep that night. The British Prime Minister has been hailed as bringing peace to Europe after signing a non-aggression pact with Germany. The Munich Agreement allowed Nazi Germany to annex the Sudetenland region of western Czechoslovakia in exchange for a promise of peace, soon to be broken. As Ursula put it, the deal gave the green light to Hitler's expansionist aims. War was coming. "He should be beaten with his own umbrella," declared Olga Moot when Ursula told her of Neville Chamberlain's deal the next morning. "And if Hitler wants to take Switzerland too, what will become of us?" The news grew steadily worse. In Spain, the Munich betrayal removed the last hope of an anti-fascist alliance, destroying Republican morale. Franco's troops advanced swiftly, and nationalist victory at the Battle of the Ebro signalled the end for the Spanish Republic and its band of international fighters. "How I wished I had been there with them," wrote Ursula, "instead of on my own front here with two children, an old woman, and 12 cows." The fascist tide was rising on all sides. With horror, she read of the events on the 9th of November, when Nazis went on the bloody rampage known as Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, destroying Jewish businesses and synagogues, murdering and arresting Jews. The Times reported, "No foreign propagandist bent on blackening Germany before the world could outdo the tale of burnings and beatings, of blackguardly assaults on defenceless and innocent people which disgraced that country yesterday." The Kaczynski Bank, founded by Robert's father and the source of the wealth that had underpinned their former life, was confiscated and Aryanized overnight. So was Ullstein, the Jewish publisher for which Ursula had worked back in 1928. Henceforth, the company would be churning out Hitler's propaganda, and Das Reich, the Nazi newspaper. From her molehill high on a Swiss hillside, Ursula wrote to her parents in London. "Our spirits, just like yours, have sunk to zero." Loitering in the crisp autumn sun outside Geneva Post Office, Alexander Foote reflected wryly that every Swiss housewife seemed to have bought an orange for lunch that day. He had no clear idea what he was doing in Switzerland. During the train journey, he wondered if he might be embroiled in a black market smuggling operation, or perhaps cast in some Scarlet Pimpernel-like role of rescuing prisoners from Dachau. This business was obviously clandestine, illegal, and in tune with his vaguely leftist politics, which was just fine with Foote. But he felt remarkably conspicuous, standing around in a white scarf with a leather belt in his hand, eyeing up every passing woman as the clock ticked down. I felt a self-conscious fool, at best self-doomed to embarrassment, and at worst to a Swiss charge of accosting. The town bell was striking 12 when he spotted her. Slim, with a good figure and even better legs, her black hair demurely dressed, she stood out from the Swiss crowd. In her early 30s, she might have been the wife of a minor French consular official. She was holding an orange and a string bag containing a green parcel. "Excuse me," said Ursula, "but where did you buy that belt?" Over coffee in a nearby cafe, each sized up the other. He was tall and a bit overweight. His hair was reddish blonde, the eyelashes were fair, complexion pale, and eyes blue. To another Englishman, his accent would have betrayed a lower middle-class background, but in Germany this would not matter. She told him to call her Sonia, and explained that henceforth in all communications he would be Jim. Foote was drawn to her. "A pleasant person and an amusing companion, my first espionage contact was not as frightening as I had expected. She spoke English with a slight foreign accent, and was, I should judge, a Russian or a Pole." Ursula observed him closely. every word, cadence, gesture, and noted that he grasped things quickly and asked sensible questions. After an hour, she had made up her mind. "You will go to Munich on a one-year tourist visa," she said. "There you will settle in, learn the language, make as many friends as possible, and keep your eyes open." He should read up about wireless technology and study basic photography. In Munich, his primary task would be to cultivate workers and officials at the BMW factory, which, in addition to cars, manufactured aircraft engines for the Luftwaffe. When Foote pointed out that he knew nothing about Germany, her response was brusque. "Look up Munich in the public library." Once established, he could communicate his address via Brigitte in London by sending her a novel. On a specific page, he should write the address using an invisible ink made by adding cornstarch to water. When iodine solution was brushed over the page, the secret writing would appear. She then handed over 2,000 Swiss francs for expenses and told Foote to meet her outside the post office in Lausanne at midday exactly 3 months hence. She gave him some simple advice on how to detect if he was being followed. Finally, she asked for a recommendation. The British battalion in Spain had been disbanded and its 305 surviving volunteers repatriated. Was there anyone else among Foote's former comrades, she asked, who might be suitable for a similar assignment to his? He thought for a moment and then suggested a communist friend who had fought alongside him during the Battle of Jarama, earning a reputation for fearlessness. This man, Foote said, was the only one of his old comrades capable of carrying out a tricky job on his own. Ursula memorized the name. Len Burton. Alexander Foote boarded the train with a light heart, a full wallet, and only the faintest sense of what the future might hold. He had been told to expect a difficult and dangerous assignment. An expenses-paid holiday in Munich seemed to be neither. Clearly, he was involved in some sort of espionage, but he had no clue who he might be spying for, nor, indeed, what spying might involve. Perhaps, he reflected, Sonia was part of the Comintern, a communist organization he had dimly heard of. Back in Britain, he collected his belongings from his sister in East Grinstead, applied for a German tourist visa, and paid another visit to Mrs. Lewis at Lawn Road to learn about conditions in Germany and confirm the secret arrangements for passing on his address. Brigitte was no longer so brisk and impersonal. They met twice more for what he called social occasions. An MI5 report later noted it is possible that Foote had a flirtation with Brigitte. The snow fell early in Switzerland that year, blanketing the mountains. "The magnificent landscape seemed to have been specially created as a backdrop for this house," wrote Ursula. Every day, 7-year-old Michael skied down to the school at Caux. On Sundays, they caught the little blue train that chugged to the top of the mountain and then skied almost a mile to the house. Nina and Ollo spent the afternoons tobogganing. Ursula began to mix among the large expatriate community in Geneva, where the spies rubbed shoulders with diplomats, journalists, and sundry others who seemed to do nothing at all. As always, Ursula made friends both with people of like mind and others of quite different views. They were all interesting. Robert Dell, the correspondent for the Manchester Guardian, and his son-in-law, David Bleloch, who worked for the International Labour Organization. An elderly Jewish woman named Lillian Jacobi, who had escaped an unhappy marriage to a rabbi. Marie Ginsburg, a librarian at the League of Nations. Diplomacy was the overriding topic of conversation in Geneva, gossip and secrets the chief currency of exchange. In this strange kaleidoscope, it was impossible to tell who was spying for whom. Many of Ursula's new acquaintances were well informed, and sometimes indiscreet, about the deteriorating international situation. She passed on whatever she gleaned to Moscow. "Was I deceiving people who were sympathetic towards me?" she wondered. Ursula also struck up a friendship with the wife of the local farmer, Frau Fusli, a kind, exhausted Swiss woman with 4 children, a domineering husband, a and friendly brown eyes. Their conversations tended to focus on how much Frau Füssli would rather be married to the farmer on the other side of the valley with whom she was conducting an affair. One spring afternoon, Johann Patra appeared at the door of the farmhouse. After their last meeting in Moscow, he had gone back to China to aid the communist insurgents, a lucky absence that probably saved him from Stalin's butchers, and was paying another brief visit to the centre before returning once more to Shanghai. He had found out where she was living and decided to drop in on Ursula unannounced. She was pleased to see him, but struck by how naive he now seemed, and dismayed at how little interest he showed in his vivacious 3-year-old daughter. "I did not blame him," she wrote, "but neither did I understand him." Perhaps they had never really understood each other. Their love affair now seemed a distant fantasy. Ollo was an ever-present helpmate, cooking, cleaning, sewing, and caring for little Nina, with whom she had established a deep bond, occasionally referring to the baby as "my child." Nanny and child shared a bedroom. At times, Ursula wondered whether Ollo's attachment to her daughter was a little obsessive. With Michael, she was overly strict. Olga Moot knew that Ursula often worked late into the night, sending messages on the transmitter hidden in the bottom of her wardrobe. When Ursula came to breakfast drained from lack of sleep, Ollo sent her back upstairs. "I see how long the light burns in your room. Stay in bed. I'll keep the children quiet." Their complicity was more open these days. Ursula even discussed what Ollo should do in the event of a police raid. "If something happens, you have seen nothing and heard nothing, and you stick with that story." As in Ursula's childhood home, the rivalry between mother and nanny was unspoken, but intense. Ollo considered herself to be the better mother, and once even hinted that Ursula's espionage was impinging on her maternal duties. Stung, Ursula shot back. "Should I give up my work because I have them, or should I give up the children because of my illegal work? Both would be impossible for me." Ollo had touched a raw nerve. When Ursula needed to send a wireless message or attend a rendezvous, she ceased mothering, and, as her own mother had done for rather different reasons, handed the job over to Ollo. She adored her children, but sometimes it was a relief to be able to pause being a mother and resume being a spy. She did not put her work ahead of her children, but she did believe she could have both a family and a career as a spy. That winter, Foote installed himself in a furnished apartment at 2 Elisabethstrasse, Munich. A university student and SS officer named Eugen Lahr agreed to teach him German and happily introduced Foote to other Nazis. As instructed, Foote bought a novel, wrote his address in secret ink, and posted it to Lorne Road. He forgot, however, to indicate which page the message was on, leaving Brigitte to soak the entire volume in iodine to bring out the secret writing. Then he relaxed. Posing as an eccentric and wealthy British tourist, he had enough pocket money and little to do save enjoy myself, something he was rather good at. Foote dined out for every meal. One day, in search of lunch, he alighted on the Osteria Bavaria on Schellingstrasse, which offered a decent-looking set menu. Foote was tucking into his deep-fried trout with Kartoffelsalat when there was a flurry at the door, and Hitler strode in. By chance, Foote had chosen to lunch in the Führer's favourite restaurant, run by a former comrade from the First World War. Hitler always ate in the rear annex, separated from the other diners by a thin wooden partition on which hung a coat rack. He was usually accompanied by his adjutant, SS Obergruppenführer Wilhelm Büchner, and several aides. Like most tyrants, Hitler was fussy about food, and his order never varied. Eggs and mayonnaise, vegetables and pasta, and compote of fruit or a raw grated apple, and Fachingerwasser, a faddish medicinal mineral water which claimed to cure stomach ailments. The Führer farted frequently during meals. No one objected. In March 1935, Hitler dined at the Osteria Bavaria with the British Nazi-sympathising Mitford sisters, Unity and Diana. One, a substantially insane Hitler groupie, the other, the mistress of Oswald Mosley, the British fascist leader. Over lunch, Diana admired Hitler's greyish-blue eyes, so dark that they often appeared brown and opaque. A year later, she married Mosley at the Berlin home of Joseph Goebbels, with Hitler in attendance. Amused to be in such infamous company, Foote took to lunching regularly at the restaurant and noted that when in Munich, Hitler ate there up to three times a week. This triviality, he wrote, was to have surprising consequences. Foote and Ursula met again, as planned, outside Lausanne post office. Sonia was still only moderately enlightening about his role, but her financial generosity was enough to allay any qualms. He was now on the payroll, she explained, with a salary of $150 a month plus expenses, in return for which he should compile reports on political and economic conditions in Germany. More intriguingly, she said he would shortly be contacted by a new collaborator. Together they should work on a possible sabotage operation and keep it on ice until such time as the director authorised it. Not much the wiser, but quite a lot richer, Foote returned to a Munich still full of tourists basking in the twilight of European peace that would not last much longer. Conversations with my SS friends and the evidence of my own eyes convinced me that it was only a matter of time before the military machine took control and the country went to war. Rudi Hamburger came to Switzerland to say farewell. Having completed a two-month radio course in Paris, he was keen to get back to China and begin working as a Soviet spy in his own right. Moscow had finally agreed to his request. He was ordered to sail from Marseille to Shanghai, accompanied by the Red Army's senior intelligence officer in the region, who was returning to China and would oversee Rudi's clandestine work. The officer was Johann Patra. For both men, the situation was, to put it mildly, odd. Johann would be working with the man he had cuckolded. Rudi would be taking orders from his wife's former lover, the biological father of the child everyone believed to be his. The centre was not known for its sensitivity, but even hard-bitten Umar Mamsurov had felt moved to ask Hamburger if he was prepared to work under Patra. As Ursula put it, generous and principled as he was, Rudi had a high opinion of Johann and agreed. Rudi was philosophical, or pretended to be. There was no personal conflict between us on account of his earlier cohabitation with my wife. As men, we understood each other. The past was the past. Rudi was determined to avoid a scene and stayed for only a few days, but the final parting from his family was supremely painful. Little Michael, deeply attached to his father, recalled the moment of separation with undimmed pain 8 decades later. I remember him saying goodbye and saying he would return soon. My mother told me he would be coming back, but he didn't. She was not honest with me about that. One day he was there, the next he was gone. I waited and waited. Ollo was also upset by Rudy's departure, unwilling to accept the marriage was really over. Ursula accompanied him to the station at Montreux. Rudi had been her first love. They had been partners in marriage, ideology and espionage since she was 18 years old. She no longer loved him, but his departure was yet another severance. She had already lost so many people she loved. Sergei and Patra, her friends Agnes, Shushin and Grisha, and countless other colleagues and comrades, friends and family destroyed by Hitler or Stalin. Her life seemed to have been measured out in painful railway station partings and dockside departures. Loyal and stubborn, Rudi was one of the few people she trusted wholly, and now he was leaving too. She stood on the platform and watched the little blue mountain train until it had disappeared round the bend. Len Burton was surprised to find himself outside the Uniprix shop in the Swiss town of Vevey on Lake Geneva at exactly 11:50 on the 15th of January 1939, holding an apple in his left hand and a folded newspaper under his right arm, and scanning the crowd for a woman carrying a net bag of oranges. The weeks since his return from Spain had been full of surprises. A message from his former commander asking him to call a number in Hampstead, then the meeting with a posh woman with a slight foreign accent who gave him money, told him to go to Switzerland, and made him memorise all the complex arrangements involving fruit, newspapers, and peculiar passwords. He had felt reassured when Mrs. Lewis mentioned Alexander Foote, his former comrade in arms. If Footy was involved, it was probably some kind of international swindle. It all sounded pretty dodgy. But Len didn't mind. He quite liked dodgy, and he certainly wasn't scared. Len didn't really understand fear. Ursula observed the handsome young Englishman from a nearby doorway. He was 25 years old, with thick brown hair, eyebrows that met, and clear hazel eyes. He was lean and athletic, strong and muscular. Len turned, saw her watching him, and smiled. "Do you like ice cream?" she asked. "No, whiskey," he replied. As they walked around Vevey, Ursula explained that Len had been recommended for dangerous work in Germany, a continuation of his fight on Spanish soil. When she warned that the job could be extremely dangerous, his face lit up. Len should return to Britain, she said, and then head for Frankfurt, home of the industrial giant IG Farben, a vital cog in the German war machine. There he should begin teaching himself German. He must tell no one where he was going. Once settled in Frankfurt, Len should contact his old friend Alexander Foote in Munich and await instructions. The young man asked no questions. He did not want to know what organisation he was working for, nor how long he would have to stay in Germany. He displayed no trace of anxiety or even hesitation. He simply put the money she gave him in his pocket, shook Ursula's hand warmly without quite meeting her eye, and walked away, grinning. Ursula was intrigued by this young Englishman, 7 years her junior. Half shy, half aggressive, he gave the impression of boyish immaturity. He struck her as a nice, modest young man, but extremely sensitive. Len Burton could not stop thinking about the woman he now knew as Sonia. "I was 25, and my experience of falling in love had been limited to boyhood worship of distant film stars. That may explain why my instantaneous reaction to Sonia has left the recollection of what was said at our first meeting somewhat cloudy. I suspect she thought I had not quite recovered from the bombing in Spain. Of course, she could not know that she was the bomb." Len fell for Ursula the instant he saw her standing on the pavement outside a Swiss supermarket holding a bag of oranges. Until this moment, Leon Charles Burton had experienced nothing remotely resembling love. Len's life started in Barking in 1914, 3 weeks into his parents' shotgun marriage. His French-born father was a hotel waiter who joined the French army on the outbreak of war and was killed within weeks of arriving at the front. Florence Burton paid for her 6-year-old son to be fostered by a widowed railway clerk named Thomas Fenton. "I'll come back in the school holidays," she told him. Every morning, he woke up with the fresh conviction that his mother would definitely come today. Len never saw his mother again. Fenton had 2 sons already and ignored his foster son. There was no affection, it was a purely commercial transaction, Len later wrote. At the age of 14, he ran away from home and found work as an agricultural labourer, then as a mechanic and lorry driver in London. At weekends, he learned to shoot at the Territorial Army gym, and during his lunch hour, he boxed at the Blackfriars boxing ring. "Many of the most colourful boxers were Jewish," he later wrote. "To make good, a Jewish boy had to be twice as tough as the non-Jewish fighters. I developed a natural respect for them." This laid the foundations for my outraged contempt when Hitler's anti-Semitism became official doctrine. At 18, he found work in a quarry on the island of Jersey, where he was befriended by an Irish-American former seaman called Moriarty. A burly giant, mild in manner and fierce in politics, Moriarty introduced Len to the radical writings of Jack London and the legend of Joe Hill, the American labor activist executed in 1915. Moriarty taught me much more than how to cut granite with a 7-pound hammer. The revolution entered my life. Together, they listened to Radio Moscow. We watched the rise of fascism and together firmly believed that the German working class would settle accounts with Hitler. We followed events in Spain and decided that the only place for an anti-fascist was in the International Brigades. Burton joined the British Battalion in Spain in January 1937, and 3 weeks later, on the 12th of February, he went into action on the Jarama Front. Many years later, he wrote up his memories of the action at Suicide Hill, one of the bloodiest of the Civil War, in which nationalist forces sought to dislodge the Republican and international troops defending the road to Madrid. That morning, the dawn came up cold, clear, and bright. The world seemed young, and we too, as the battalion, 600 strong, climbed up to the ridge above the Jarama. By nightfall, we were no more than 300. On the morning of the 13th, we numbered 225. On the 14th, we were 140. That historic 14th broke the back of the fascist offensive. The lifeline of the Madrid-Valencia road had been saved. The battalion buried its dead. From the British working class, none ever died with greater honour. We held that front for 4 months. Solidarity and unity, old Moriarty had said, are the two most beautiful words in the revolutionary's lexicon. The Jarama proved how right he was. The battalion was the first family Burton had ever known, and within a month of being adopted by it, 3/4 were dead. Len was, understandably, an insecure man, oversensitive and quick to complain. He was happiest on his own, behind the lines, wandering the Spanish countryside during lulls in the fighting. But he had one very remarkable quality. He was immune to fear. He was not brave exactly, but he was nerveless at moments when others were terrified. An American psychologist interviewed him at the height of the fighting and declared he had never met anyone so completely devoid of physical fear. In February 1937, Burton was driving a lorry from the battalion cookhouse with Captain George Nathan in the passenger seat when the vehicle took a direct hit from an artillery shell. Burton emerged from the wreckage not only unscathed, but weirdly cheerful. He lost 2 more trucks to strafing, without registering a whiff of anxiety. My nervous system, I had discovered, operated efficiently under stress, he wrote. In April 1939, Len Burton caught the train from Frankfurt to Munich and rang the doorbell of No. 2 Elisabethstrasse. Foote was delighted, and not very surprised, to discover that the new comrade Sonia had referred to was his old friend Len. He suggested they have lunch at the Osteria Bavaria, in order, as he put it, to have a look at Hitler. Sure enough, the Englishman had scarcely sat down when they were told to put out their cigarettes, as the fanatically anti-smoking Führer was about to arrive. We didn't have to give the salute because we were British subjects, but we stood up like the rest. 2 women were also waiting for the Führer's arrival. One was Unity Mitford, Hitler's British acolyte, and the other was his mistress, Eva Braun. They clearly couldn't stand each other, Len observed. Hitler greeted his 2 female guests, bowing and kissing each by the hand, and then processed through the restaurant to loud applause. At that moment, Len reached into the inside pocket of his jacket. He was searching for his cigarette case, but to Foote, the movement looked as though he was going to draw a revolver. He was horrified. There must have been a fair sprinkling of trigger-happy Gestapo agents among Hitler's entourage who would open fire at any hint of an assassination attempt. nothing whatever happened. The Führer's goons stood around looking bored as Len pulled out his cigarettes and Hitler disappeared into the back parlour. Foot breathed again, reflecting, "It's a wonder no one tries to bump him off, considering the lack of precautions taken on these informal occasions." Sonia had told Foot and Burton to identify sabotage opportunities inside Nazi Germany, some target that might be dramatically destroyed in a way that would impede German rearmament and attract the attention of the international press. Len believed he had already found the ideal objective. His friendly landlord took him to see the Graf Zeppelin, the mighty passenger-carrying, hydrogen-filled airship. In 1936, Goebbels sent the Zeppelin on a tour of Germany, dropping propaganda leaflets and blaring loud martial music. The great flying machine had been decommissioned and was now on display in a huge hangar at Frankfurt Airport, a proud symbol of German scientific prowess, military might, and national pride. Len suggested they blow it up. Foot told him not to be ridiculous. But the more they discussed it, the more feasible a sabotage operation seemed. Burton insisted it would be perfectly easy to put a time bomb with a slow fuse in a cigarette packet under one of the seats and let it and the hydrogen in the envelope do the rest. He returned for another look, carefully inspecting the cushions and curtains and the impregnated canvas skin. If an incendiary device was planted in the gondola, the whole airship would go up like a giant firework. At the next rendezvous with Ursula in Veve, Foot outlined the plan. Sonia was extremely excited and explained that an effective bomb could be constructed from sugar, aluminium powder, and charcoal. A moderately accurate time fuse was not difficult to make, giving the saboteurs ample time to escape before it went off. She invited Foot to come to the house the next morning so that we could try out the mixture in peace and quiet. An odd way to describe detonating a homemade bomb. Foot was pleased by the invitation to Sonia's home. I felt it was a step forward in my initiation into the network. In the lean-to shed abutting La Taupinière, they mixed the bomb and inserted a time fuse. The whole thing fitted inside a cigarette packet. Then they placed the incendiary device under a sofa cushion and took cover inside the house. The only result was a large quantity of black smoke and an unholy stink. If it could not set fire to a cotton cushion, the bomb was extremely unlikely to ignite the thick leather upholstery of the Zeppelin. Over dinner, they agreed the plan was probably unfeasible. The conversation turned to Foot's life in Munich. He told her how he had taken to eating at the Osteria Bavaria, where Hitler frequently lunched with his dozy bodyguards. It would be easy to put a bomb in a suitcase beneath the coats and hats which hung on the partition wall separating Hitler from the main restaurant, he idly observed. Sonia's response stunned him. What an excellent idea. Just fancy, he later observed. She expected me to assassinate Hitler. Foot returned to Munich, and Ursula immediately sent a message to Moscow, reporting that Agent Jim had presented an opportunity for coming close to Hitler and assassinating him. The response came back. The director is extremely interested in the report on Hitler. Foot should check up on his movements and habits. The snow melted, wrote Ursula, and the spring had a fairy tale beauty. The warmer weather brought a flood of wild daffodils to the hills above the chalet, and no fewer than three spies to the molehill. Alexander Foot and Len Burton travelled separately to Switzerland and checked into a Montreux boarding house, the Pension Elizabeth, overlooking Bonport on Lake Geneva. The next day, while the children and Ollo made their way through a sea of flowers picking arms full of daffodils, the three conspirators sat in Ursula's kitchen and discussed how to murder Hitler. Foot was distinctly alarmed to discover that in the intervening weeks, the ambiguous injunction to keep an eye on Hitler at the Osteria Bavaria had burgeoned in the eyes of the Kremlin into a full-blown scheme for assassination, with Len and myself apparently cast for the principal roles. Burton was enthusiastic. What could be easier than to put a time bomb in an attaché case along with our coats and, having had an early lunch, abandon the lot in the hope that the bomb would blow Hitler and his entourage